he was like pushing all these things that like even the most ideological people in the Trump administration thought were too extreme. Steve Bannon was like, it was just too crazy, you know? Wow. And it's like, if Steve Bannon is saying something is too crazy, it tells you something.
Hey everyone, Max here, filling in for John again. Here's a somewhat contrarian thought for you. If there is one figure on the American right, aside from Donald Trump, who is most important for understanding the trajectory of Republican politics today, it might be the tech investor Peter Thiel. Thiel is not as famous or as rich as Elon Musk. He's not as notorious as Steve Bannon or Richard Spencer. But over the last 10 years, he has grown from Silicon Valley's oddball conservative to Republican Party kingmaker and an ideological anchor of the party's Trump and maybe its post-Trump eras. Joining me to walk us through Peter Thiel's growing influence and his, to me, quite scary agenda is Bloomberg Businessweek reporter Max Chafkin. Max is the author of The Contrarian, Peter Thiel and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power. It is a great book that gets more and more timely by the day. Max, welcome to Offline.
Thanks for having me.
So in a moment, we'll kind of rewind and tell the Peter Thiel story from the beginning. But just to level set for people, can you give us a bird's eye overview of Thiel's role in the Republican Party today?
Thiel is, as you said, a really important venture capitalist, very, very important Silicon Valley investor. He's probably, you know, one of the top two or three most influential investors in the tech investors in the world. And he's also been a sort of pioneer in a lot of these kind of hard right ideas that were popularized by Donald Trump and J.D. Vance and others, was a seed investor, if you will, in Trumpism.
Right. And kind of the high point, or at least the high visibility mark for his influence is, and we'll get into this later, like arguably picking the vice presidential candidate for Trump's 2024 ticket, which is a wild thing for a single donor to do, regardless of that donor's background.
Yeah, Thiel in 2022 made two enormous donations, political donations to midterm Senate candidates, hard right, kind of younger, more sort of like Trump, but maybe a little bit more disciplined, a little bit more ideological. Mm-hmm. And one of those two was J.D. Vance. J.D. Vance also worked for Peter Thiel. He is, in many ways, not a business protege of Thiel, but a political protege.
Right. Okay, so let's rewind and kind of start the story at the beginning-ish. You often hear people talk about Thiel's undergrad years at Stanford in the late 80s, described as kind of his, like, ideological origin story. How true is that, do you think?
Well, I think Thiel coming up in the 80s was interested in right-wing politics. And at the time, it was sort of like in the water back then. It's actually become much more popular now to sort of complain about the, you know, leftward drift of academic institutions. There are a lot of people doing this very sort of loudly back at the time. Ann Coulter, Dinesh D'Souza, and Thiel was one of these figures. He started a right-wing newspaper at Stanford, Stanford Review. And the work that was produced, and you can go back and read it. I read a lot of this for my book.
I'm so sorry.
It's extreme. It's trolling. Thank you. It's not especially noteworthy. Thiel has written some super interesting speeches and some great essays, or, you know, some sort of really, in my opinion, well-constructed, provocative essays. There's not much like remarkable about the writing. It's just sort of standard issue trolling, as far as I could tell. You know, it's a lot of jokes about race, gender, and so on. What's most interesting is that network then became the core of this technology network. Thiel sort of, a lot of these guys who he knew from Stanford, these conservatives, became co-founders or very early employees of PayPal, became sort of central to a tech network that then became very, very influential. And, you know, when people think of Silicon Valley, now a lot of this is kind of a myth, but there's this like a myth of Silicon Valley as this kind of like left-leaning mm-hmm. place. And, mm-hmm. and but of course, the roots of at least one of the most important tech networks is definitely on the right in that kind of like trolling campus activism arm of conservatism.
So Thiel is kind of at the center of this Venn diagram, it sounds like, of On the one hand, you have this very specific late 80s movement of kind of right-wing young college kids at big, otherwise left-wing campuses, elite universities, who are kind of representing this, like, the colleges are too woke backlash, like before we would refer to it as anti-woke, and like running these student conservative newspapers and people like Ann Coulter, Dinesh D'Souza. And then the other circle that Peter Thiel falls in is the late 80s kind of Stanford-centric early tech, like the people who would come into the dot-com boom. And his like being at the middle of these two worlds, at the intersection of these two worlds, it feels like it kind of becomes his superpower later in life.
100%. He's sort of, you know, he was at Stanford in the late 80s, early 90s. He actually briefly became a corporate lawyer. He was a very ambitious guy, but he returned to Silicon Valley in the late 90s, like just as the internet was taking off. He was friends with a lot of people and essentially was able to plug in to some really successful ideas. And you know, he is both like ideologically and as a tech guy, an investor, somebody mm-hmm. who is very adept at looking for promising young people. Almost everybody in his network is a man. Almost everybody is a white man. And they're all very ideologically conservative. He's good at seeing these kind of conservative rebels, these bomb thrower types. And I think that shows up both in the sort of political folks like Vance that he's picked out, but also in the tech folks. Like, mm-hmm. you know, Thiel was, his big win as an investor was Facebook, was seeing Mark Zuckerberg and thinking, this guy has something. And I think, first of all, that's very impressive because, you know, Zuckerberg had essentially been sort of tossed out of Harvard. He'd done this kind of sketchy, arguably pretty gross thing involving the, you know, ranking the faces of his classmates. Mm-hmm. And you can sort of see why somebody like Thiel would like that, right? He's somebody who loves to, you know, piss off a university administrator. And I think that was what appealed to him about Zuckerberg. And you just see it like over and over again. And it's turned out to be like a pretty effective investing philosophy. I think you could question whether it's the kind of philosophy you'd want in sort of choosing like the future leaders of the country.
So there's an important stopover before he comes to Silicon Valley and kind of gets involved in the PayPals and the Facebooks, but that I think helps to set up exactly what you're talking about, this thing that starts as an investing strategy, but then later becomes a political philosophy, which is that in 1995, when he's either 27 or 28, I'm not sure, he publishes his first book or co-authors it, The Diversity Myth, that was not particularly impactful at the time, but is kind of looked back on as important for understanding him. Can you talk about what that book says?
The Diversity Myth is ostensibly a sort of like memoir confessional written by two Stanford students, Peter Thiel and this guy David Sacks, who also became an mm-hmm. investor, was involved in PayPal.
Who spoke at the RNC,
yes. He's sort of become like the poor man's Peter Thiel, if you're trying to find a... The book really is like another one of these, like it's very similar to the D'Souza wrote a very similar book. The title is now, is escaping me, but I probably have it right behind me. But anyway, the point is, it's all about how Stanford is this kind of left-wing place. Minorities and black people and women have too much power. It's full of lines that are pretty cringy in retrospect. You know, there's a description of date rape as being seductions later regretted. You know, they sort of question the whole concept. And what's interesting anyway is and maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, but when Trump, when Thiel donated to Trump in 2016, he and David Sacks issued these kind of sort of semi mea culpa. This was after the Excess Hollywood tape. I think the Trump people or maybe Thiel and Sacks intuited it, that there was something kind of gross about Trump, this guy who'd been accused of, you know, bragging about sexual assault, taking money from a couple of guys who'd written these super insensitive things about date rape. And so, and they sort of issued these kind of half-hearted mea culpas. They apologized for certain things, didn't fully apologize it, but you almost get the sense since then that they would want to like take those, you know, like a lot of the stuff that they were apologizing for, I'm not sure would have been apologized for in, you know, 2024. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, it's just, but the book put Thiel, he got on TV a little bit. He wrote a couple of like Wall Street Journal, like editorial type things. And then kind of went away. And that's when he found his way into tech investing.
Well, something that I think is interesting to highlight about this book is that on the one hand, if you don't know Silicon Valley well, you go back and you read excerpts from it, and it's like, this is really nuts. This is like, I can't believe that someone is just saying out loud that diversity is bad and you should only hire people who look like you, which he says explicitly in the book. But at the same time, like, this is kind of a mainstream, or at least was at the time, a mainstream view in Silicon Valley. Like John Doerr, who is one of the most respected venture capitalists, he gives like this first big investment in Google. He like kind of shepherds YouTube, all of these tech companies that we know well. He's like the godfather of. He was quoted as kind of notoriously saying that, I think he called it pattern recognition, that the best founders were young white men who dropped out from college, which is a crazy thing to say out loud. But it's just to say that, like, something that I think is really important to keep in mind is that Peter Thiel both represents this, like, far-right fringe of Silicon Valley, but also Silicon Valley.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I think partly because in the 2000s, mm-hmm. Google was very successful. And Obama got elected in 2008 and embraced the technology industry. And this kind of narrative settled in of Silicon Valley as being essentially like a progressive industry. And it's true. Like there are people in tech who are progressives or would identify that way. But the industry like has this entirely different thread, a very conservative thread. It's an industry that was born in the military industrial complex, who many of, you know, there have been prominent tech Republicans forever. And I think Thiel represents a kind of a twist on that, because there was sort of like a general kind of like libertarian thrust to Silicon Valley politics, and he is not exactly a libertarian. He's more like a hard right, a nationalist populist, whatever you want to call it. He's Trumpy, and that's new. But like, yes, as you said, like a lot of these values are really embedded in the culture of the technology industry. And you know, Thiel wrote this book, The Diversity Myth, in the mid-90s, and he came back and wrote a business book that was very successful.
Zero to One.
Some of his lectures, Zero to One. And yeah, and it argues essentially, like it attempts to sort of, there's a lot of interesting and provocative stuff. It was very popular among founders, but it does suggest that like mm-hmm. you want companies where everyone kind of thinks the same. You want ultra powerful chief executives. And it's got a lot of ideas that I think, number one, are, I don't know, questionable as business advice, but that also if you could be taken into weird places if you so choose to, and certainly people have.
Yeah, Zero to One is one of those books that at the time was greeted as this like brilliant business book. And I went to work at one point at a media startup, and we were all told that this was one of like two or three books that we had to read to understand startup culture. But if you go back and read it now, understanding, or at least I understanding Peter Thiel and who he is better, there's some scary stuff in there. And it's also just like an incredibly important book for understanding what tech and Silicon Valley was going to become. Because of course, what the title refers to, Zero to One, is that you see the thing that he's saying you should do as a tech startup founder is that you should go to some market that doesn't exist, and that you should go from, you know, it's zero because there is no service that lets you order taxis on your phone. And then you're the first person who invents that, and you control 100% of the market. It's overtly a pro-monopoly book, which certainly puts him at odds with, our girl Lina Khan.
Well, it's also, I mean, to me, like the central point of Zero to One, and kind of like the probably like the most important part of Peter Thiel's ideology and a lot of the ideology of Silicon Valley over the last couple of decades, is that people who succeed do so because they break the rules, because they do right. not follow the consensus viewpoint. And whether that consensus viewpoint is unspoken, just a cultural norm that you're breaking, or whether it is an explicit law, like you cannot operate a car service, an unlicensed car service in our city. Mm-hmm. And his idea is, it's not just that that it's acceptable if a startup maybe doesn't follow all the rules. I think most people kind of believe that like small companies, you're talking about like a three-person business, like they're not going to be as good at compliance as like a gigantic corporate law firm. That's, I think, somewhere close to conventional wisdom. Thiel's arguing, though, that it's a moral imperative, mm-hmm. that like you should break the rules, that mm-hmm. that society, that if we just listened to what we as a society have agreed on, then that is a bad thing. We will get stagnation. And he thinks stagnation is the worst possible thing. And you can understand why that is like an interesting, provocative idea, but it also is incredibly anti-democratic. Right. Like a lot of these rules. Like some rules are good and some rules are bad, but like a lot of rules are rules because the majority of people agreed on them. And because after much consideration or whatever, we've decided that like, you know, we want people who are driving around in cars in our cities to have some oversight or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And just sort of unilaterally saying like, all of this is bad has a lot of implication. I think it helps explain like a lot of the ways in which Silicon Valley sort of, you know, at least from a critic's point of view, got out of control during the you know, 2010s.
Something that I also read into his tech worldview and like what he was writing into Zero to One is both, like you said, that in order to succeed, you have to break the rules, but also that if you are successful, if your business does better, that means that you are inherently better and that your ideas are inherently superior. And it's this kind of social Darwinian might makes right, that it's one thing if you're talking about like, you know, your food delivery platform outcompetes the other ones, but it's another thing if you're talking about like, okay, well, if you can suppress the will of demographics that you don't like at the polling place, then that means that you are better and that it's right that you ruled unilaterally.
Yeah, I mean, my take on it reading it is that he's saying that these like technologists are superior in every way.
Right.
And that like yes. essentially like these people who are building the future are superior, are morally superior. Like we need to just like the world would be a better place if we got out of their way. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the people who aren't that. And like, you know, and then we would, you know, then we would cure cancer and live forever or whatever, or, you know, have super fast planes or something. Like that's a convenient worldview for a Silicon Valley venture capitalist.
Yes,
it's sort of like
it's very self-serving.
If you're not Peter Thiel, it's not so great for you. But if you are Peter Thiel, it's a wonderful worldview. And I do think, you know, what Thiel understood like very early was that there is this kind of it's not Silicon Valley is a business thing, but it's also sort of there are social movement aspects to it. There are these young large numbers of like young men. In particular, but some women as well, who read that book, Zero to One, as a manual, as like a self-help book. And mm-hmm. and it's basically telling you that you, disaffected young person, can become rich and famous by following none of the rules. Like you can become Peter Thiel. Like you can have total autonomy, total freedom. And I think it sort of like helps explain like at least some corners of kind of like the online MAGA world, right? Like
yeah.
these, he understood that this was a powerful thing and attempted to tap into it. And, mm-hmm. and since then other figures have also tried. There are questions about just how big it is though, just how politically valuable it will be.
Let me ask you about when he first started to rise as an ideological figure just within Silicon Valley before he gets involved in national politics. So like you mentioned, he moves to Silicon Valley in the late 90s. He gets involved in a series of startups. Some of them, PayPal, Facebook, of course, become enormously successful. He also founds the analytics firm Palantir, which continues to outsource to the military and intelligence agencies. And obviously, he became very rich. But of course, a lot of tech investors in this period became very rich. So what was it about Peter Thiel that he was starting to become more than just like one of the other rich founders, but someone who was also kind of a like ideological lodestone in the valley?
Well, you said something like this earlier in the conversation, but I do think what his, the sort of genius, if you want to call it that, of the way Thiel has approached his career is combining money and ideology, like understanding that money, that ideology can be a valuable way to make money. And that money can also put an idea, can advance an ideology. And, you know, a lot of folks in Silicon Valley, especially back then, it's very fashionable to be like, oh, I don't care about, I'm apolitical or
sure,
something like that.
Sure.
And I think, you know, a lot of time that's just a front or whatever, and it has to do with the, I don't know, like the culture of the place. And but Thiel, you know, PayPal, which was online payments, that had an ideological component. You know, the idea, PayPal was framed explicitly as a libertarian technology. I mean, if you go back and read how Peter Thiel was talking about PayPal in the late 90s, early 2000s, talking about it the way the kind of like extreme Bitcoin people talk about, like this will be a way for people to avoid the controls of governments. And later, you know, Palantir was a business. It was a software company, you know, for military applications, but it had a political, it was formed after 9/11 at a time when there was a lot of excitement about data mining and so on, in a sense that, you know, we'd gone wrong by like failing to do better surveillance of terrorists that were in the United States. And so like it had a political component. And so like I think is one area where he has been very successful. The other thing is like this, the Peter Thiel style of contrarianism, which is kind of like, you know, at times it can feel like dorm room type thinking, where you just like one person says one thing, you just say the other, you know? that can work in an industry like tech, especially in venture capital, because, you know, venture capitalists, they make a lot of very small bets. And the idea is a few of them pay off. So like, you don't really necessarily care if like one of your crazy ideas turns out to be a crazy idea, as long as like, you know, a small percentage of them actually pay off. And then the other thing is like, he was very good at sort of like taking these assets, his success, at PayPal, his network, this like incredibly, influential group of people that then went out into the world, and then his kind of like his somewhat modest profile as like a political thinker, or like a, as he likes to call it, a public intellectual, and sort of leverage that and build that into a brand, like and turn that into a thing with a following and with you know, a best-selling book and this venture capital firm that he started, Founders Fund, that sort of like attempted to like push these out further, and then also to benefit from it financially.
So there is one idea of his in particular that you often hear said is his scariest, or at least his most important, which is the idea that he opposes democracy. He once wrote very famously, or infamously, I should say, quote, "I no longer believe that freedom and democracy are compatible." He said that society should not be trusted to the unthinking demos, which is a Greek term for citizens or voters. So is this a case where you think he's just being a provocateur and he's saying things to get a rise out of people? Or do you think he genuinely feels that we would be better off without democracy?
I think he genuinely has. I think it's real. Like,
really?
I mean, I don't know that he lives in the United States. You know, he has citizenship in other countries. He certainly could leave. So like my assumption is, and he said this recently on a podcast, like he's, you know, conflicted about staying in the United States or whatever. Like, I'm not saying he's like a, totally opposed to, you know, to existing as a citizen in our democracy. But I do think that the quote you just read is compatible with many of the choices that he's made, with the core things that he's advocated for. Like, if you want, as Peter Thiel does, you know, the future to happen as quickly as possible, like you want to have like radical expansion of drug discovery or like, you know, some people are going to get hurt and like democracy gets in the way of that. And so I think, yeah, I mean, he thinks genuinely that democracy as practiced is a constraint. And again, he's a provocateur. And so you always have to be a little careful about these things, but I do think, you know, you see that in some of his actions and in not just in his own actions, but in the actions of many of the people with whom he's been, you know, closely associated.
It does feel like he is to some extent just carrying to its logical endpoint a viewpoint that has been pretty common in Silicon Valley since at least the early 90s that says that, you know, like you were saying, we in Silicon Valley, we are the leaders of the future. We are inventing all these great companies. The economy is doing poorly and we're doing great. That means that we are inherently smarter and better. And, you know, like Mark Zuckerberg, when he founds Facebook, he talks about it, and he's just a kid, so who knows how much he's actually thinking this through, but he talks about it as replacing all of the old institutions for how media and society and government were supposed to work. And there's this idea that, like, we are out here inventing the future and we're going to be in charge of it because we're smarter. And maybe in some ways, Peter Thiel is the only one who's brave enough to say, and that means it will be in place of all those idiots out there outside of Silicon Valley having their vote.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like I said, I think that a lot of these ideas are more wide, like the sort of Peter Thiel worldview is much more mainstream in tech than you'd realize, and including is sort of mainstream among people, even some people who are active in Democratic Party politics. Mm. You know, Thiel has this like longtime association with this guy Reid Hoffman, who's been who's a founder of LinkedIn, who's a prominent Dem donor. And I think when you like kind of look close, like Hoffman believes a lot of the same things that Peter Thiel believes, but has chosen to, you know, I'm not saying that Hoffman also is opposed to American democracy, but like when you look at what he's saying about tech companies and how they should be regulated and so on, like a lot of it's kind of the same. But he is advocating, he's attempting to take, you know, pick a different channel for influence. And Thiel, particularly, you know, once he started backing Trump, has made his choice. Like he's gonna try to influence the Republican Party or influence our society from this direction.
Right. Yeah. No. Of course, I think we agree that Reid Hoffman and Mark Zuckerberg are not going to be leading another January 6th. But I do think about moments like, you know, when Myanmar first opened up and Eric Schmidt from Google went there. And I think that he really believed that bringing like Google's products and services in place of the old dictatorship, that was going to be the thing that would like liberate the society. And he wasn't saying, don't worry, Myanmar, you're not going to have voting. You're going to have Google and YouTube. I think he saw them as compatible, but there is a belief that our products and services, everybody should use them, and that will bring us to the enlightenment. And by the way, it will also make all of us rich this is something that Peter Thiel also talks about, that those two things should not be in tension, and that if your tech company is making you rich, that means that you are improving humanity.
Yeah, and I also think, you know, when I was writing this book about Thiel, like I thought a lot about, I was thinking a lot about the Koch brothers and the success that the Koch brothers had in sort of convincing the world, convincing people on both sides that like libertarian values were the way to go. And that like, cause you know, it's like their influence project was more effective like on the right. But I think a lot of people on the left kind of internalized a lot of their ideas that they and their close associates were pushing. And I think it's similar with this sort of like idea that rule following and democracy is a problem. Like a lot of Democrats believe, frankly, that startups should ignore regulation. And everyone there's been a real backlash to this over the last few years. You know, you mentioned Lina Khan. You know, a lot that's happened, I think, over the last 4 years has pushed back on that. But I think the just general notion that like tech knows better and that we should get out of the way of tech was broadly accepted by everybody, not just by the right, not just by libertarians, but by most people.
Sure. No, I think that's absolutely true. There was another line from this Peter Thiel 2009 blog post that he wrote where he talks about opposing democracy that I wanted to ask you about, because I don't want to say I don't know what it means, because it's very clear what it means, but it really felt to me like, whoa, this came out of nowhere. He says that since 1920, the vast increase in welfare beneficiaries and the extension of the franchise to women have rendered the notion of capitalist democracy into an oxymoron. Whoa.
Thiel, after this came out, he wrote this, I'm sure knowing there would be a backlash. This was published by the Cato Institute, and he wrote a follow-up attempting to clarify the comment. And his point, he said, was that he wasn't specifically interested in denying the franchise to women. He was just against voting in general, like that, and which is a pretty thin. It's like a pretty thin explanation, that it's not that he wasn't coming at it from a place of sexism. He was coming at it from a place of being against voting, which again, like I think it's kind of strange. Mm-hmm. At the time that happened, people took that explanation. I wrote about this. People took that explanation basically at face value, as if it were just like a totally normal way to explain it. But you know, and especially like. In light of the as these beliefs have become more common and have been weaponized to some extent by mm-hmm. you know by people like Donald Trump, on January 6th or what have you, I think that it bears sort of reevaluating and maybe asking like that's a pretty extreme point of view.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you about when. Or one of the big moments when Peter Thiel started to really push into these more extreme views, and it, at least to my eyes, stake out a set of positions that were pretty far outside of even the kind of the weirdest Silicon Valley beliefs, which is also around the 2000s. He started to become friendly with a guy named Curtis Yarvin, who is a far right blogger and programmer, also known by a pseudonym, Mencius Moldbug. Can you tell us about Yarvin's beliefs and his connection with Thiel?
Yes.
Yarvin, like you said, he's a blogger and a tech guy. And he, after making a little bit of money during the dot-com boom, started writing this blog. I brought up the dorm room thing. Like, Yarvin is like a very literary, like hyper-literary, hyper-verbal. Everything is like 1,000 different references. And there are all these names, some of which are weird. And anyway, but it's like this, he's like the guy, in the dorm who's like, reading the obscure, whatever, Italian fascist trait and right. treatise and arguing, that this would be an awesome way to organize society. But in any case, his idea, it's called like formalism, or neo-reaction. Mm-hmm. It's essentially arguing that life would be better, our society would be better if we replaced our current democracy with a sort of corporate dictatorship, a dictatorship mm-hmm. run by a CEO. I think Yarvin, there's lots of stuff that's like pretty odious that he has written over the years, racism and anti-Semitism and, just a lot of extreme, I think provocation. You know, he's a provocateur, and it's always hard with somebody like that to know, like, are they actually arguing that we want to, replace the United States of America with with Eric Schmidt or something? Or is it just, is this just a thought exercise or whatever? But it became, these ideas became very influential in, mm-hmm. Within Thiel's circle. And I think Thiel, you can sort of see Yarvin's ideas show up in this business book, this pretty anodyne, mm-hmm. Business book that like a lot of people read. And like, the Harvard Business Review probably reviewed, I can't remember, but like, that just like totally became like a mainstream way of looking at business. But, Thiel talks about how, there's a section in the book called like Founders as Gods. That's in Thiel's book, and how, right. And it talks about how the best companies are like dictatorships. And you mm-hmm. you do see some parallels. Thiel also invested in a company that Yarvin was a co-founder in, has sort of kept him close to many, many folks in Yarvin's network. And now, you can really see a lot of the ideas that Yarvin has talked about, like coming out of the mouths of some famous venture capitalists, mm-hmm. Marc Andreessen, who's the co-founder of Netscape, major investor, and Sachs, and mm-hmm. like he is a, I think in the book I called him like Thiel's like in-house philosopher or something like that. He's somebody who is like the an intellectual who Thiel became a patron of, a right-wing intellectual, and he became influential within the kind of far right parts of the conservative movement or the MAGA movement or whatever.
And they're also directly connected, right? I mean, it's like, as Curtis Yarvin is arguing, we need to quote unquote reboot American democracy and replace it with a dictatorship. He's going to Peter Thiel's election watch parties.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. They watched the election together. I wrote in the book. And like I said, Thiel invested in Yarvin's company. There may be other financial connections, although I don't know for sure. There's lots of, Yarvin has been prolific over the past decade or so as like a sort of right-wing financier, some sort of strange stuff. Like there was an anti-woke film festival like in New York. Thiel has co-invested in some of that stuff. And I think has introduced Yarvin to people, in his circle, and is a connection point between, say, Yarvin and J.D. Vance, or Yarvin and some of these other folks. Yarvin, they hang out together.
Right. Wow, that sounds so fun. So, how does Peter Thiel then get involved in national politics? Because initially, he's not super Trumpy, at least in his like kind of involvement in elections, right?
Well, Thiel was like way back. I think he's ambitious, and so he has shifted. He has shifted his ambitions to sort of suit whatever the political moment is. Founding Palantir around the time of the George W. Bush years, like that. I think if you talked to him back then at an official gathering, he would have sounded like a George Bush conservative, and has sort of shifted to suit the time. But I will say, like, he's been pretty out there for a long time. So like he donated to a pretty hard right anti-immigration group called Numbers USA, like very, very outside the mainstream back in the 2000s, back in the Bush years when like most Republicans and Democrats were talking about, comprehensive immigration. Like George W. Bush was relatively dovish on immigration, and Thiel, I think, was very much outside of that school. He was much more in the kind of like Ron Paul universe. He gravitated towards Ron Paul initially before supporting Donald Trump. And in the book, I talk about this. Like a lot of people who are like really excited about Paul, because he had initially in 2016 gotten behind Paul. He funded his PAC. And a lot of the Paul people were like really excited because they thought like we've got it, like we finally have like a billionaire who's gonna like who gets it, and what they realized like at the end of it is that no, like he just saw what he saw was not that he wanted that like Ron Paul was right about everything, but that there was this like social movement, this like the sort of like throw a bomb into the entire system thing, and that Donald Trump was a much better representative of that. Thiel got behind Trump relatively early, before many people like either in mainstream politics or business supported him, and like that's why when he endorsed Trump in 2016 at the Republican National Convention, like that was a big deal because he was like the only like sort of normal business person.
It was really taboo
at the time,
back then.
Totally. And at the time, like, it was really interesting because I'd been covering, like, I'm a tech reporter. That's how I came at this. And it was like, everyone was so like, how could Peter Thiel, he's an immigrant, he's gay. Mm-hmm. He started all these like companies that are all about like doing commerce in different countries that are all about free trade. Like, how is he getting behind this like proud Luddite? Like he had said all these things about how Donald Trump was like, it was bad and distasteful. And I think the reasons are like twofold. Like one is that Thiel's sort of view of stagnation, that like there's something wrong with the world and we need to like get out of the way of technology so they can fix it. That's like very compatible with MAGA. It's a similarly kind of like, even though Thiel's a technologist, it's a reactionary ideology. It's saying like life was better in the 1950s and 60s. And that's kind of like what Trump was saying. And this other part of it was that Thiel really believes that like political correctness, that these kind of like shared cultural taboos about around like race and gender and stuff are like bad. And Trump was going around breaking those. So, mm-hmm. I mean, like, I think actually his worldview is like pretty compatible with Trumpism. And in that way, like, it was like a revelation, like, I mean, for both of them, because, mm-hmm. because it became like a pretty important alliance in 2016.
Yeah, that's a great point that the way that he had approached startups in 0 to 1, where it's like you take an old industry and you completely destroy it and you replace it with your startup, that is kind of what he saw Trump as doing with politics, that he's going to completely tear down the institutions, the political establishment, and create this new order in its place. Like you said, it was a really big deal that he endorsed him. He spoke at the RNC that year. He gave him a bunch of money, although what would turn out to be a relatively small sum compared to what he would end up giving later. And I think I saw it got reported that he even had a temporary office in the Trump Tower to help pick out people to staff the administration.
Yeah, after Trump was elected,
right.
Thiel became had an important role. Was on the transition committee. Brought in a bunch of his close associates, including Blake Masters, who would later, you know, run for Senate, was part of that cohort that went into Trump Tower. You know, the interesting thing about that donation, he made it after the Access Hollywood tape. So, like, it
That's
wasn't
right.
just the money. It was that Thiel was really, like, the first prominent person to just be like, it's okay. You know, mm-hmm. it's okay that Trump said this. Because if you remember, at the time, like, a lot of Republicans went and condemned it and so on. And Thiel condemned it in his own way, but he sort of spun it. And he gave this, like, he had this, like, press conference where he right around the time that he made this $1 million donation, where he essentially said, like, I find a lot of this stuff distasteful, but Trump is our guy. And the quote he used, which was repeated over and over again, which he actually cribbed from an Atlantic story, but was that we need to take Trump. I don't know that he ever claimed it was an original line, but you know, he did not coin it, but it was attributed to him, and it was, you should not take Trump literally, you should take him seriously. So
That's
it's
right.
like, who cares if he says a couple of weird things about, you know, women, like on the big stuff, he's right. That was how Thiel reframed it. And I think that helped like create a permission structure
mm-hmm.
for a lot of people. And it has since like become part of like the narrative around Trump, that you just sort of like, if you support him, you forgive some of the weird stuff or the sexism or the racism or whatever, because like, and this is how a lot of people in kind of like, on Wall Street and business and so on have kind of since rationalized their
sure.
support.
Right. Yeah. Looking back, I really did not appreciate how important Peter Thiel was during the 2016 election, but it really comes through.
Don't you wish everything was more rewarding? With Rakuten, almost everything is. You can earn cash back on those new shoes you've been wanting. You can save on the next trip you book. You can cash in on groceries. Just join, shop your favorite brands, and save. Target, Instacart, Expedia, Macy's, Sephora, CVS, the list is long. Save online, in-store, and at over 22,000 restaurants. And when it's time to redeem those rewards, get your money exactly how you want it. Choose PayPal, check, Bilt points, or cash out with gift cards. Eligible American Express card members can choose to earn membership rewards points instead of cash back. Terms and conditions apply. So go ahead, take a trip, fill a cart, order dessert. Rakuten is a world of rewards. Join today for free. Go to Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app. That's Rakuten.
Hey, folks, we'll be back to my interview with Max Chafkin in a second. But first, want to do everything you possibly can to make sure Peter Thiel doesn't get his way and his weird-ass protege J.D. Vance never makes it to the White House? Now is the time to volunteer. As we've said and continue to say, this election is going to be incredibly close and will come down to the margins. That's why we are very excited to announce that Vote Save America has set a big goal, 75,000 volunteer signups for their 2024 Organize or Else program by September 17th, which is National Voter Registration Day. Mark your calendars. Vote Save America provides the highest impact ways you can take action right now to support down-ballot races in must-win districts and build momentum for the Harris-Walz ticket. To put this in perspective. In 2020, Biden won by just 44,000 votes in Georgia, Arizona, and Wisconsin. The margin of victory is tiny, but if we recruit enough volunteers, we can close the gap, secure a win for Kamala. You can help Vote Save America hit that number with just a few volunteer shifts. Vote Save America will walk you through the process so you can hit the ground running. And if you've volunteered with Vote Save America before, still make sure to sign up for this 2024 program so you're provided the latest actions. Go to votesaveamerica.com/2024 to sign up. This message has been paid for by Vote Save America. You can learn more at votesaveamerica.com. And this ad has not been authorized by any candidate or candidates committee. Now back to the interview. So after Trump is elected, Thiel has a falling out with Trump, as everybody who came into office with Trump does. Very common story. And then during 2020, he kind of found this new rising far-right star to back, who was Kris Kobach. So tell us about Thiel and Kobach, how they got linked up, and what happened.
Yeah, Kobach had been involved with that immigration group that I mentioned. So they had known each other for a very long time. Kobach was like Thiel, the immigration stuff. It's kind of weird because he's an immigrant and Silicon, and you know, Silicon Valley, you know, is an industry that where many of the founders are immigrants. A lot of the labor force was born in different countries. But yeah, I mean, he Kobach was like a hardliner on this stuff. And I think Thiel, the funny thing is, like, after as the Trump presidency wound down, everyone sort of assumed that Thiel had backed away from Trump because he, and Thiel really just said nothing about it or gave very few interviews. Right. Everyone assumed he backed away because like Trump was like too crazy or like, you know, too hardline or something. The kind of thing you might hear if you talk to like one of the more like mainstream business people who are involved with Trump. But it was really the opposite. It was that Trump was ineffective, that he was not hardline enough. And like in the book, I talk about this, like one of the reasons Thiel kind of crashed out of the presidency and like had a falling out with Trump after the transition is because he was like pushing all these things that like even the most ideological people in the Trump administration thought were too extreme. Steve Bannon was like, it was just too crazy, you know? Uh-huh. And it's like, if Steve Bannon is saying something is too crazy, you know, that's whatever, like that, it tells you something. And so I think with Kobach, and then later with Masters and Vance, he was looking for people who were, and the phrase that I heard when I was writing the book and reporting the book, and I started in like 2019, was like Trumpism beyond Trump. Like somebody, like people who are going to be advocates for this worldview, but are not going to be tied up in the cult of personality. Because from the, which is kind of, you could argue, and I think it'd probably make a pretty compelling argument that there's no such thing as Trumpism beyond Trump. But I think, but the ideology was very exciting to Thiel. Whereas the cult of personality, I think, was like a less, wasn't the draw for him. It was like breaking norms, hardline nationalism, you know, the kind of authoritarian impulses to some extent that Trump embodied, not the fact that he was like this cool New York billionaire, like with his name on a lot of buildings.
Right. And if you look at Kobach, the things he's associated with, it gives you some pretty big hints to where he's going, right? Kobach recommends at one point that the Trump administration start a Muslim registry, which is pretty terrifying. He's a big, like, quote-unquote election fraud guy, which I think you could read as saying that he basically wants to, you know, invalidate votes that don't go his way. And then Thiel executes this on this to an even greater degree, a much greater degree, after the 2020 election, which he mostly sits out. And then in 2022, in those midterms, he spends $32 million, which is, I would argue, quite a lot, over 16 different candidates. So it kind of looks to me like he's trying to set up this like Peter Thiel Republican caucus. And a lot of them are primary challengers, which is to say his goal is not just to get Republicans elected, but to change the Republican Party. So when you look at these 16 people who he's backing, which include, of course, J.D. Vance and Blake Masters, as you said, like what does this kind of Thiel coalition look like that he's trying to put together? What do they represent?
So I think A lot of it is like the sort of ideological values associated with Donald Trump. So hardline immigration, like cultural conservatism, like no, you know, got to stop the wokes or whatever. The sort of like extreme version of the anti-political correctness position that Thiel laid out, you know, way back in the 80s and 90s, and youth. I mean, you know, Thiel is somebody who I don't think it's an accident that like the candidates he's backing were younger, much younger. You know, Blake Masters, he may be 40. I think he's like in his late 30s. You know, Vance is not super old. Mm-hmm. Kobach, I think, is a little older than those guys, but certainly, you know, of a different generation. And I think the idea initially was to kind of keep the ideology and ease out the man. And because back when he started this push, really Trump was at his lowest point, you know, post January 6th, like, it did not look like Trump was going to be able to make a political comeback. And I think what became clear in 22 is that there's no version of that, of pushing that ideology without Trump. And you had this kind of, during the 22 race, you had kind of an alliance of convenience form between Trump and Thiel, where Thiel made these kind of extreme candidates who, as you said, deny the election results, mm-hmm. build the wall, mm-hmm. You know, own the libs, like that whole thing. And then Thiel gave them money, made them viable. And then Trump got behind them. And in doing so managed to like, to kind of edge out a bunch of more sort of establishment candidates. And the big story back then was kind of like, it wasn't Democrats versus Republicans. It was like Mitch McConnell and the kind of like more moderate, more electable type of Republicans versus the, you know, election deniers. And Thiel, you know, I don't think he initially set out to do this, but it ended up being a part of Trump's essentially his return to influence in the Republican Party, because it became clear that like you couldn't win a primary race without getting his endorsement. Right. So Trump got behind Vance and Thiel helped pay the bills. And the same thing with Blake Masters, who is like, you know, Vance and Thiel were not that close. Blake Masters was really close to Peter Thiel, mm-hmm. had worked with him for like, you know, his whole entire
years
adult life.
Years. Yeah.
Masters lost in Arizona to Mark Kelly, you know, an incumbent. Vance won a much easier race. Like once Vance won his primary, the race was going to be a lot easier because Ohio, you know, is a red state. And so Vance gets in, Masters doesn't. And I think that 22, both it sort of helped solidify Trump as like, you know, the main attraction, and Thiel as like a crucial financier or a string puller behind the scenes.
And Thiel is also the one who first introduces J.D. Vance and Trump, and also helps to kind of clean up the relationship after Vance had called Trump like a dictator, Hitler in waiting, or something, right?
Yeah. Thiel brought him to meet with Trump and, you know, became that connection point, the person essentially who not only vouched for Vance, but like I said, made Vance viable. Because like, mm-hmm. Vance... very little experience, you know, not a huge resume beyond like a best-selling book and a lot of media hits where he'd like insulted Trump and Trump's followers. So on the face of it, not a super promising candidate for public office. But because he had this association with Thiel, and because Thiel was able to bring him into the fold with Trump, made him one of the Republican Party's rising stars.
So there's something seemingly kind of odd in a lot of the people who Thiel backs in the party, in that they tend to be some of the most vocal Republican Party critics of the tech industry, right? J.D. Vance, Tom Cotton, Josh Hawley. And that seems on its face surprising, given that Thiel is, of course, himself of the tech industry. So can you explain what's happening there?
I mean, it's odd, and it's hard to reconcile to some extent, although let me suggest a few reasons why. Mm-hmm. So Thiel himself has been a critic of the tech industry, he wrote this book, Zero to One, that you mentioned, that was sort of all about monopolies, and you could read it as a how-to manual where you're like, you should, you know, you should have a monopoly just like Google does. But Thiel was also pointedly calling Google a major competitor to Facebook and a factor in Thiel's professional life. A rival essentially to Thiel. He's sort of calling out a rival, and I think a lot of what he's done is attempted to train regulatory fire and cultural anxiety and whatever else at his like business rivals.
Oh,
later at the at the National Conservatism Conference. This is like a annual gathering of the kind of like MAGA. It's like an intellectual part of the MAGA movement. Yarvin goes to these events. Anyway, Thiel gave a speech where he like says that Google has been infiltrated by the Chinese Communist Party and should be investigated. Kind of implied that he said like the CIA should investigate this and not be, I forget the exact quote, but it's like, and not be super gentle or something.
Oh my God.
Which like, I think he was attempting to be provocative, but he's explicitly attacking a rival.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of it is that. And I also think that Thiel has like legitimate cultural concerns, not legitimate in the sense that I endorse them.
But I understand.
Legitimate in the sense that they are actual
them.
Beliefs
They're
that
earnest.
He feels.
Yeah.
About the way that like these big social networks, including Facebook, which he invested in, kind of like enforce cultural norms and so on. Like it kind of goes against his idea that you should break the rules because they sort of enforce their own rules. So I think it's like a combination of those two things. But I also think even among these sort of Thiel acolytes who sound very like anti-tech, if you actually like look at what they want to do,
mm-hmm.
it's a lot of things that would benefit at least like big sectors of their network in Silicon Valley.
Right.
So like a lot of these, you're hearing this phrase more and more when you talk to like conservative donors, but they talk about little tech versus big tech.
Mm-hmm.
And like, so like they want to crack down on Apple and Google, but they want to protect the startups because that's how they make their money.
That's where their money is. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Also J.D. Vance is like against regulating crypto, which is like a strange view for an Ohio populist. Like it doesn't really make any sense, except I don't think there are a lot of like auto workers or whatever who want to, you know, who think it's like really important that the SEC not classify Ethereum as a security. But like there is a constituency that does care about that, and
mm-hmm.
that happens to be like J.D. Vance's donor base.
Mm-hmm.
And not just that, but like the world. He's not really a venture capitalist in the same way that Peter Thiel is, but it is kind of the world that he comes from. So like, mm-hmm. I think when you look closely, like at a lot of these guys who are even like, you know, raising grievances about the tech industry, it's pretty careful. And it's often done in a way to protect their interest with an acknowledgement that some regulation is coming.
Yeah. That has always been kind of my theory. Although with Thiel, it does seem like there is a, as you said, earnest ideological belief there too. And he left Facebook's board, I don't know, it was maybe a year or two ago. He said, I would rather have QAnon and Pizzagate than a Ministry of Truth, which is yikes. Let me ask you about Thiel's relationship with Trump right now, because it was reported in a few places that last April, Trump called Thiel to ask him to turn the money spigot back on. And one report said that Trump asked him for $10 million. And Thiel has said publicly that he said no and that he's refusing to donate to Trump and he will vote for him only reluctantly, even though he now has his protege on the ticket. Like, why do you think he's still holding out?
So there was a break. My understanding, anyway, is that there was a break in 22, partly because Masters and Vance would not go full, like we're like not wholehearted enough. Trump felt that you can see some of this. There was a documentary of Masters, and there's a call between him and Trump where Trump is sort of like chastising him for like not being like enough of an election denier. They're kind of going with like election denialism light versus like the sort of more muscular Like, I think Carrie Lake, who's like a political rival to Blake Masters, was like more enthusiastic about election denial. And but they're both kind of election deniers, but they're gradients. And I think, and then the other thing is, like, these candidates, like, Thiel didn't have a great, like, these candidates didn't have great results. Like, Thiel, Masters lost. J.D. Vance won, but he wildly underperformed the Republican governor. You know, he didn't, he did not win by a huge margin. Like, I think, you know, I think Thiel may have felt frustrated or whatever. You know, a lot of these Silicon Valley guys, even the rich guys, like, they tend to be pretty cheap. And so spending a huge sum of money and then not seeing returns, you know, that is motivating. Hmm. And then I also think that Thiel, you know, there's a family component. Thiel, I wrote about this in the book. Thiel's kids, I think in some ways he just stopped wanting to be in the limelight. On the other hand, it's not like he stopped being influential. I think he's still, despite the fact that he hasn't written like a check to a reportable campaign contribution, like a check to Trump or to a Trump-aligned super PAC, I would not assume that he has stopped donating money to Trump-aligned causes. And I think he is still, I think he was active in helping to get Vance on the ticket and advancing his interests. I mean, the weird thing that's happened is like Thiel always seemed kind of like a little bit embarrassed to be a Trump supporter.
Yeah.
And like this new group of Silicon Valley Trump supporters, of which like Elon Musk is probably like the loudest and, you know, maybe best example, like there's no embarrassment. There's no like seriously, not literally, right? They seem prepared to take Trump, you know, literally as well as seriously and just like to totally embrace MAGAism. And that is the thing about this election that to me is so strange and jarring, is that like back when I was writing the book, Thiel during his like Trump support got kind of close to the alt-right and was having meetings with various alt-right figures, like in secret, and like he wasn't like out and out endorsing like or openly interacting with like white supremacists or anything like that. There was just a suggestion maybe he had met with some, you know, edgy people. Whereas like Elon Musk is just like tweeting that stuff out. I mean, it's just like an incredible shift. Like there's no, you know, like the that's the thing that has been most amazing to watch, is just how the Overton window has shifted in Silicon Valley towards like an open embrace of this stuff rather than just being kind of secretive about it.
Yeah, right. And it being not just Peter Thiel and not even just Elon Musk, but like you mentioned, Andreessen and Horowitz, who are two huge, huge figures in the Valley with a ton of money, who have come out very pro-Trump. And I mean, who knows what will happen after this election, but I would certainly have my eyes on them as influential figures in the party going forward. Well, Max, thank you so much for coming on. It was a great and terrifying and fascinating to chat about Peter Thiel, someone who I know so much more about than, I would say I wanted to know a lot about him. I think it's important that we know about him, but I really appreciate you coming on to chat.
Thanks for having me, Max.
Offline is a Crooked Media production. It's written and hosted by me, Jon Favreau, along with Max Fisher. It's produced by Austin Fisher. Emma Illick-Frank is our associate producer. Mixed and edited by Jordan Cantor. Audio support from Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Jordan Katz and Kenny Siegel take care of our music. Thanks to Ari Schwartz, Madeline Herringer, and Reed Cherlin for production support. And to our digital team, Elijah Cohn and Delon Villanueva, who film and share our episodes as videos every week.